Harvey, Reel 5. You were saying about this case.
This family, a Muslim family, a young wife of 25 and a husband who was 29 and a child of 2. And they had been subjected to nightly terrors of their Serb neighbours, storming around outside the house, shooting guns into the air, smashing the windows with bricks, and creating chaos and damage outside the house, killing their animals by slitting their throats, so that the family would find these horrible things in the morning. They hardly slept, obviously, they were terrified. They would huddle together in one room. And one such night, the people perpetrating these things must have become bolder. I don't know if they'd been drinking or what, but they came inside the house. And the family was absolutely terrified, obviously. The wife ran outside and crouched in the flower bed. And she could hear her husband being beaten and beaten and beaten. And she could hear him trying to fight them off and to put up a struggle, but she couldn't. He couldn't do anything, and she couldn't do anything to help him. She was just paralysed by fear outside. And in fact, they killed him. When she heard him make no more noise, she heard them say, "Let's find the wife and rape her." So she ran and she ran and she ran into the fields, and they chased her and they caught up with her and they raped her. And then they left her. They didn't kill her. She just left lying. In the morning, she got up and went back to the house and found her daughter, her 2-year-old, who was crouched beside her father's body, and she'd seen what had gone on. Now, she didn't know that her husband was dead. At this stage, she calls for help or something, and they took the husband to hospital. And meanwhile, we were called, and I went to see her and to talk to her, and agreed that I would take her to visit her husband in hospital. We didn't even know he was dead. I just remember driving to the hospital and being called over the radio by one of the other ICRC delegates to say, "He's dead, so don't go to the hospital." Now, this was in English, and she was a Bosnian Muslim. She didn't speak any English. She didn't know what had been said, and I just thought, oh, I'm going to have to tell her. So we went instead to the ICRC delegation office, and she said, "Why have you brought me here? Why haven't you brought me to the hospital? I know. He's dead, isn't he?" And so I had to tell her that in fact he was, and she just became hysterical. Not surprised. I mean, she just cried and cried and screamed and shouted and yelled and wanted to see him. She wanted to see him. So I arranged that we would go together to the mortuary. Now, I hadn't seen him either, and I didn't know what he'd look like. So we went together to the mortuary, and it was pretty awful because it was full. The mortuary was full, and they just pulled him onto the floor, and he was just lying there on the floor, still in his blood-soaked clothes. And I have never seen a more horrific-looking body. It reminded me of the film Cry Freedom, when you see Steve Biko and he's beaten to death in South Africa. It was just a face, beaten black and blue. And she said she only recognised him by his clothes. His whole head was swollen, so swollen and discoloured and misshapen. And I wish I hadn't taken her, because the poor woman was beside herself with hysteria. And she in fact fainted, and my translator Sasha had to carry her back to the car. And I suppose I might play that differently if I had to do it again. I don't know. She wanted to see him and she saw him, but maybe now her living memory of her husband will be how he looked in death. I don't know. Anyway, this lady obviously became one of our protection cases, and we got her out. In fact, she went to Holland, and hopefully she started a new life with her daughter in Holland. But it was a long process for her still to get out, and She was terrified. She lived in fear those next few weeks until she got out. And she had to obtain so many legal documents from the Serb authorities to be allowed to go. And she lived through more harassment in those last few weeks. And she even had to pay Deutschmarks to the clerks in the offices that she went to be given the stamp of approval to be allowed out. And these were just, this was money lining their pockets, obviously. And, you know, after having your husband brutally murdered like that, to pay for the privilege to leave is just despicable. Her treatment was just appalling. So you don't feel good about things like that, although ultimately we were able to help her to get out. Before that, we weren't able to protect her or her husband from what had happened. So there's not much fulfillment in that kind of work. And also in knowing what's going on and not being able to speak about it. I suppose that's why it's so therapeutic to talk now, because with the ICRC, you can't make those things known. And there are journalists around, there are people swarming around who pay richly for a story like that. I mean, obviously I wouldn't want money for it, but I sometimes felt I just want to tell the world what's going on. But I couldn't, because that would have just meant the end of all our activities inside that part of Bosnia. And it was tenuous anyway. There were times when they wouldn't allow us in, and as well as our medical work and our protection work, the ICRC was bringing in food, winter clothing, for the vulnerable people in that area. And if the Serbs wanted, they could close the road. Couldn't get through the checkpoint. So, you know, we were at their mercy anyway. They didn't need anything else, like me talking about atrocities that I'd seen, if they wanted to stop our activities. So we were putty in our hands a bit, and that worked in lots of ways. With the medical supplies, I mean, some hospitals, Serb hospitals, who were perhaps quite well supplied through Belgrade, didn't need our assistance as much as some more vulnerable hospitals. But the Serbs could say things like, you give us 50%, what can you do? Mostly, actually, I was able to say we give on a needs basis, and I make the assessments, and they don't know what I give to others and what I give to them. But they could check our trucks as they came through the checkpoints, and they could count what we had. They could loot what they wanted if they wanted them. Later on, that did happen around Sarajevo. They took stuff from our trucks. So it's a dirty game. And in a way, to be there, you have to a little bit abide by their rules. Don't mean that you play dirty, but you have to be a victim to what's going on a bit.
You obviously, you know, had a lot to do with the rape cases, victims of rape, from all sides. But in Bihać, as you say, it would have been the Serb mainly. What was the effects of those rapes? You know, were the effects very severe, would you say, the trauma?
I think one of the things about rape is that the trauma goes on and on and on. And it's something that I don't see the end of. You know, the people that have been raped live with it for the rest of their lives. The fear of it, the feeling of total degradation and of having been sullied, and the outrage of having such an act committed against you. It's something I don't understand. Obviously, I haven't been through it, but I know that people don't just get over a rape. It goes on. And when it's combined with trauma after trauma after trauma, as happens in war, with so many other things going on besides, people perhaps repress their feelings about the rape because at the same time their brother was murdered, or their husband was murdered, or somebody in their family is fighting on the front line. There are always more pressing things for them to think about and to concentrate on and maybe to grieve over than just to think about themselves and their rape. And so I think that there are going to be women grieving over what's happened to them for years to come when they finally face it. When the war is eventually over, the traumas of the effects will go on. A lot of young girls were raped, and that's harrowing. Girls, prepubertal girls, they can't possibly understand what has happened to them, and that's not just traumatic for them, but for their mothers and for their fathers and their families. That's the outrage they feel about that. And some very old ladies as well. We saw some 70, 80 year old ladies that had been raped, and that is just sickening as well. People just used as vessels, and not just raped by one man, maybe raped by a few. Yeah.
How prepared were you to deal with that? Because obviously, you know, not only the physical aspect, but you were counselling, weren't you? You were trying to help them psychologically. You know, how demanding was that for you, do you think?
I think I hadn't really been prepared. I mean, I'd never worked with rape victims in this country, and that's not something you can exactly be prepared for in your briefing. But I think you rise to cope with the situation that you have to, and you get given the strength that you need at the time. I was frustrated that I didn't speak Serbo-Croatian. Obviously, counselling on a one-to-one, you need to speak the language, and I was always having to speak through an interpreter. Now, my interpreter in those days in Banja Luka was, in fact, a male. His name was Sasha, and he was a medical student. And that's perhaps not the best person to have when you're counselling rape victims. But his English was good, and he was all I had. But having said that, I think he was absolutely wonderful. He had a lot of perhaps what we would call feminine qualities. Very, very gentle person, very sympathetic and understanding, and very kind. And I loved him. 100 times over, I could have hugged Sasha for his sensitivity and kindness, even though he wasn't perhaps the person one would have chosen to have. But he was very natural with the women. And I hope that it didn't distress any of them too much to have to relate through a male what had happened. I think I gave them opportunities, if they didn't wish to tell me with him present, not to talk about it to us then, but, you know, to talk to another female friend in her own language at another time. But most people actually didn't seem to mind. What was more important was the attitude that we displayed to them. I think when they've been through such a horrific thing as a rape, they almost didn't seem to mind telling whoever they told. I think they've lost it all. They've been totally violated. They've been through this most despicable thing. Just telling it in front of a man isn't actually any big shakes after what's happened, I assume, because it really didn't seem to be a problem. I mean, you know, maybe in the best of circumstances we would have chosen a woman, but we didn't have the best of circumstances. It was a war.
Were you ever faced with a pregnancy, you know, due to a rape case?
No, I wasn't, actually. Never. We were faced with a girl who was 13 who'd been raped and really feared she was pregnant because it was some months after the rape, I think 5, and she said she hadn't had a period. And so there was a very real fear that she was pregnant. And it was my task to get this girl from the village and bring her back to the hospital for a scan. And there's absolutely no way she and her mother or family would have come. They wouldn't have ventured out of their house on their own. So I was to go and take her. But it was one of those awful stories. When we got to the village had been cleansed and there was nobody there. We were prevented at first from getting into the village by all sorts of stories about the road being blocked and we couldn't go along there because the people would throw stones at us. I mean, the very people we were going to see. I mean, absolute rubbish. And this was the Serb soldiers on the nearest checkpoint, and they were laughing and joking and carrying on. And, you know, for all I know, it could have been some of them that had raped her. And they knew very well why we wanted to get access to that village. And they'd obviously got orders from higher up not to let us. So we didn't make it that day, but we made it another day. And when we got there, the village was completely empty of people. Nobody was there. So whether they'd been killed, whether they'd fled, whether they'd been forcibly moved on, I don't know. So I never found this girl, and I don't know what's happened.
Did you ever see any evidence in that area of sort of massacres, mass graves or anything?
I never saw mass graves or evidence of massacres in that way. But what I did see was evidence of individual slaughters. And this was back in the Bihać pocket area. We would visit a place which we called the Pink Zones. Now, the Pink Zones were the areas around the dividing line between Bihać pocket Muslim area and the Krajina part, where the predominantly Serbs areas were. And these Pink Zones were a few villages that were sort of no man's land, really, neither one thing nor the other. And they were rural areas, a lot of old people living alone. The young people had mostly gone because the Pink Zones were not a nice place to live. The young families had left, so they were living in the cities and the towns with other people of their same ethnic group. But with old people, it's not so easy. Mostly they don't like to leave their homes that they've been in all their lives and lived through a previous war. They want to stay, and they're quite stubborn and adamant that if they're going to die, they're going to die in their own homes. So these Pink Zones had a lot of villages with fairly elderly residents. And sadly, a lot of these residents were terrorised and traumatised by soldiers who would, maybe they'd be off duty and they'd just come larking around, perhaps with a few drinks, driving around, shooting and just generally victimising by their behaviour, these poor old folk that lived around. And they were terrified. They would just stay in their homes, absolutely petrified and afraid to go out. And we would supply them with food. Often the ICRC take food parcels to them. And the next time we'd go back, we'd hear stories about how it was stolen from them, and soldiers would come in and eat all their food in front of them and knock them around a bit. Generally it was that, but I do remember one awful time when we were told we couldn't go to the Pink Zones, and we had to get permission to go to the Pink Zones because they were military areas or something, so it wasn't always that easy just to get access. But one time we were told we couldn't go, and then of course you're highly suspicious as to why you can't go, but you can't go. And the next time we went back, one very, very old lady, I think she must have been about 90, and she still had lived by herself in her village with a well outside. It was so rural, that was her only source of water. And she wasn't there. Her house was empty, and her dog was yapping. Her slippers were still by the front door. There was evidence of her having been there, not having left in a hurry. There was food out, bread. And we just felt really scared that something had happened to her. And we scouted around inside the house, looked for whatever we could find, evidence as to where she might have gone. And outside, we couldn't find her, and we kept hunting. And then we found her body down the well, and her throat had been cut, and the body put down the well. Nobody else knew what had happened, none of the other villagers. because they'd all been too afraid and just stayed in their own homes. But of course they were all petrified that they might be next. And when we told the authorities, their line was always the same, always the same. It was uncontrolled elements who did that. And that was the same answer you got every time. Same with the wife and the husband that was beaten to death and the wife who was raped. It's never their responsibility. It's never the army. It's uncontrolled elements. So we did manage, I think, to evacuate some of the elderly residents around the pink zones. I remember one couple, two old sisters that were living in a barn. Their house had been set on fire, burnt down completely, everything gone. So they just moved into the barn, and they made themselves beds with bits of straw and planks of wood, and just living in this drafty barn with the animals.
Did you get a sense of what their former life had been? You know, was it a... Would they have had a good...
Oh, yeah. A land of plenty, really. Bosnia is a beautiful country. It's a very rich and fertile place. They grow everything. Fruit, vegetables. They make šljivovice out of plums, which is their local sort of brandy drink. And everybody spoke about what an abundantly rich life they had before. And later, when I was working in Sarajevo with the young people there, their continual cry would be that we had such a good life before. Why has this happened? Why? They really didn't want for very much. Far from it being a sort of austere communist country that we imagine others, Yugoslavia was reasonably good in terms of lifestyle for the individual. A lot of people had younger members of the family working as gastarbeiters abroad, a lot in Austria, earning currency and sending it back so that the family could build their own home. And you see a lot of half-built buildings, half-constructed homes, but nice homes with balconies and all mod cons, really. And it's one of the things, actually, that struck me most about the war in Bosnia was the identification to the way I live, to the way we live, is so strong. It's a European culture and a fairly affluent European culture like our own that gives you such a strong sense of identification with the people. The young people wear clothes like we wear, where they wear jeans and leather jackets, and they listen to the same sort of pop music. They go out to see films that we would see. They have holidays like we do. A lot of them speak English. They read the books we like. It's such a strong identity that it makes you feel this could happen to us. I felt that far more than I ever did with the Vietnamese, with the Kurds, with the Rwandan refugees, because Bosnia is Europe.
So could I ask you now about Sarajevo?
Yes. Well, I did 6 months as my first contract with the ICRC, and I was shattered at the end of it, actually. I came home and was very tired, and I had about 3 months in the UK, and I rested. But also during that 3 months, I could not get Bosnia out of my mind. It was on the telly still, it was on the papers, it was on the radio, it was on everybody's minds, and everybody talked about it. And after a bit of time unwinding and resting and having a good holiday and a good break, I realised that I wanted to go back. And if I went back, I wanted to go back to Sarajevo or somewhere in central Bosnia where it was really happening, I think. Having been in Banja Luka, which is Serb-held, and I spent most of the time really in Banja Luka, I wanted to go to somewhere that was back to being Bosnian Muslim-held. I think it does help to see both sides of the confrontation, to be on both sides. So when the Red Cross, the British Red Cross, rang me up again and asked if I'd like to go back to Sarajevo as a field nurse, I didn't even need to think about it. I just said yes straight away on the phone. And I told my parents, and I think it wasn't such a shock to them really, because they knew I wanted to go back. And I think Sarajevo does evoke a lot of images in people's minds, which perhaps did worry my parents, but to me it just enthralled me. to be going really to the place where it, the heart of it all really. So I went back in March 94, and it was initially a 6-month contract, but I extended and stayed there for 9 months. And it was a mind-blowing experience, really, even though I'd had time in Bosnia before. And I'm very glad I had, because it prepared me in so many ways for what was to come. It couldn't totally prepare me for all that I was to see and to do. For a start, all the road routes into Sarajevo at that time were closed. There's no way you could drive in, so you have to fly in. And the airport is at the mercy of the Serbs. They can close it when they like. They can shoot at the planes and then they stop flying. ICRC has its own plane, as does the UN. The UN has great big troop carrying planes, and the ICRC at that time had a big Ilyushin, so quite a big plane which we would fly in food and medical supplies and also personnel. And the ICRC plane is painted white with a big Red Cross emblem on the side, and it's very clearly, distinctly visible from the air that it's an ICRC plane. And the UN planes are usually grey with UN painted on the side. As far as I remember, the ICRC plane was not once shot at on takeoff or landing into Sarajevo. Many times UN flights were shot at. And to me, that's a clear indication of the ICRC's neutrality being respected. We did work on both sides of the confrontation, and we were seen to be neutral. And I think one thing which you can't overemphasise is the fact that we worked with prisoners of war in places of detention, and both sides knew that. And the prisoners of war are a very powerful weapon, if you like. The Serbs knew that we were visiting their boys in Muslim jails, and the Muslims knew that we were visiting Serb boys in Muslim jails. And that's how it was easier for us to get access around the country, to fly in and out of the airport, because they knew we were going to see their boys. So we flew in, and when you come into Sarajevo by plane, the plane comes at quite a high altitude and then suddenly nosedives, so that it's not coming in at an acute angle, which it has greater opportunity to be shot, but it sort of plummets like a stone when it reaches the airport. So it's quite an experience. You're meant to put your flak jacket on, although I often used to think, if they're going to shoot at you, it's going to come up your bottom. And anyway, what's the good of a flak jacket? But anyway, one does. And I was lucky enough to go into the cockpit as we flew into Sarajevo the first time and looked at the approach. And it's quite something, really, because the airport is a place that's been heavily contested and fought over, and all around there the houses are totally destroyed. But their houses, like a it's like a housing estate. You can imagine a housing estate of Barrett houses in Britain, but with every window shattered and bullet holes through the woodwork and crater holes in the roof where shells have gone, and just every single house or block of flats, not destroyed always, but marked, but damaged, badly damaged, every single one, just row upon row upon row upon row. It's quite a scene of devastation, really, coming into the airport. Then you land on the runway and you have to put your helmet on and run, because the runway being so exposed, it's a good place for sniper fire. And so you put your helmet on and you make a dash from the aircraft to the main building, which is sandbagged, heavily sandbagged. So you just run behind the sandbags. And then you're there. And then you drive into Sarajevo. Now, as I say, around the airport, the Serbs are pretty much in control. And so you have to go through a Serb checkpoint. Then you go through a bit of kind of no man's land, and then you go through a Bosnian Muslim checkpoint, and then you're in the city. So it's a bit tense getting in, really, at those checkpoints, because they know you've come off a plane and they kind of want to check what you might or might not have with you. So they can search you at the checkpoints. And I remember my very first time, I was just sort of terrified they were going to go through all my personal belongings and take anything they wanted. But they didn't. I mean, they did look through everything, but they didn't take anything. And I hadn't brought a camera, because one of the ICRC rules is that you don't take cameras with you, because obviously you're in places that are very, very sensitive. And it could, again, jeopardise the whole ICRC mission if you started taking pictures at checkpoints and flashing around with your camera, which